Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is writer and environmentalist Priyanka Kumar, and we're talking about her book, The Light Between Apple Trees, Rediscovering the Wild Through a Beloved American Fruit. Priyanka, it's such a pleasure to, it's such a pleasure to talk to you again after, it seems like it's been years, but it hasn't been that long, has it?
No, I think it's just been 3 years since Conversations with Birds. It's a real joy to be here, Mark. Thank you.
And you have written it. Well, this may sound weird to listeners, but it's a delightful book. And yeah, I don't get the chance to say that a lot. And it's about a very specific part of your personality where you're enchanted by apples. And that's the word I came up with after reading this book. You're like enthralled with apples. And you realize something set off a memory. And you realize this began when you were very young, living in Assam.
Right. Yeah, during the pandemic, living here in Santa Fe, New Mexico, I really upped my hiking and walking game. And I started to stumble upon these old, abandoned orchards. Sometimes they'd be a little private orchard, sometimes a historic orchard. And I felt like these orchards had a powerful draw. Huh. And I kept circling back to them every week, and I wanted to figure out what was going on. And essentially two things happened. I realized that I had been holding on to a formative memory from back when I was, you know, two and then four and five, when I had been living in the heart of an apple-growing region in the foothills of the Himalayas. And, you know, as a little child, I had meandered through these mature mother apple trees and experienced them as elders towering over me and developed an intimacy with these trees. And I guess I hadn't realized that they had taken root in my heart. Huh. So when I was meandering through these apple orchards in and around Santa Fe, all of this stuff started to come back to me, and I felt like I needed to go on a journey to unpack this. But also what I was blown away by is that apple orchards, especially ones that are nestled against the wild, can be havens of biodiversity.
Oh, yeah.
So I was seeing every creature from the hummingbird to the yellow-breasted chat to the brown bear, you know, getting sustenance from these orchards. And that really got me thinking about a concept that I ended up developing and now called the microwild. And that, for me, is as much as you say, Mark, I'm enchanted by apples, I'm also enchanted by the microwild and the possibility of the microwild to reconnect us to the natural world.
Well, although apples are the main theme of your book, another major theme that runs throughout your book is your concern about the overdevelopment of the land and the loss of these little pocket areas of micro wild that you can, that people could just enjoy, that they wouldn't have to go so far to hike out into a wilderness area. That we, around us, we have these areas, if only they wouldn't get developed constantly.
Exactly. And I saw it happening right before my eyes. And I think a lot of us experienced it all across the country. During the pandemic, there was a surge of development.
Oh,
and
yeah,
some of the really smaller, beautiful places like Santa Fe, and I know friends have talked to me about similar surges in, you know, different places in Oregon, for instance, because people wanted to come here and live in these lovely spots and work remotely, which is all very nice, but I think that these fragments of nature, what I called microwild, are so precious because back in the day, Mark, back let's say, several decades back, people were, you know, people who were, let's say, in their 70s or 80s today, when they were kids, they came back home from school and they could just run out into nature and play. And sadly, we don't have nature right around us anymore. But we still have these gems, these little slivers of nature. And during the pandemic, I saw even those slivers being developed right before my eyes. And, you know, I tried to reach out to all kinds of people from the mayor on down. And it's almost as though politicians speak a different language and you can't always get through to them.
I you know, I know exactly what you're talking about. There are these little pocket areas, and everybody, it's really easy to, not easy, but it's much easier to save these big, you know, impressive, visually impressive areas and turn them into you know, wildlife management areas or mm-hmm. or national parks. But these small areas that are around us that might be only the size of a couple of house lots or maybe even smaller.
Right.
It's really hard to whip up enthusiasm to save those.
But I think it's so important that we turn our efforts to those areas, that we identify the microwilds
yeah.
in our greater neighborhoods and figure out a way to save these areas. Because I feel like these are the last little
yeah.
pockets of little wildernesses that are teachers for us, that there's such potential for taking children there. They're more accessible to elderly people who may not be able to get to the national forests or wilderness areas. So these are little slivers of nature that, and you're right, sometimes they're so small. You know, you can walk from end to end in, you know, anywhere from half an hour to an hour. And yet, they harbor this incredible biodiversity.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, some of the best experiences I've had birding have been in places like this. So I think it's really important to think about them and think about how we could formalize conserving such areas.
Now, you're facing an additional problem in the Southwest, and that's this enduring drought. Can you just address that so people around the states can understand what you're going through?
Yeah, so in the South, we've been in a mega drought for something like the last 22 years. And
that's a lot.
What that essentially means is, well, I can tell you what it means personally is that, you know, as I relate in the book, well over a decade back, we tried to plant some fruit trees in our garden. And whereas in normal times, even though, you know, we're a dry area, we planted trees that are suited to our zone. In normal times, you know, they would have done quite well. We would have matured trees by now, but almost all of those trees died. And it's not just me, but I am constantly talking to, you know, small organic farmers in this greater area, and everyone's experiencing the same kind of thing. And as I relate in the book, there's one of my favorite orchardists in the village of Chimayu, New Mexico, and his name is John Trujillo, who grows just the best apples, and his pears are... it feels like, you know, you're biting into caramel and these lovely, lovely cherries. And, you know, he came, I was visiting his orchard one fall, and he said to me that he's going to stop planting fruit trees. He just won't plant them anymore. Yes. And I was shocked because this is a third generation orchardist. He is taking care of some of the trees he's taking care of were planted by his grandfather back in the 1940s. And as he was telling me this, his own granddaughter, his 13-year-old granddaughter, was running around. And it just really felt devastating because I felt like I can see what global warming and climate change is doing. And it's not just, you know, something abstract, but I can actually see that he was able to carry on the legacy of his grandfather But his own granddaughter will not be able to carry on his legacy because he's going to stop planting fruit trees because it's just too hard with this mega drought.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight, and it is always a definite pleasure to talk to her, is writer, environmentalist Priyanka Kumar. And we've been talking about her new book, The Light Between Apple Trees, Rediscovering the Wild Through a Beloved Human Fruit. Before we go any further, Priyanka, you have to define again rasa. Because we talked about this in the last time we talked, but people have probably forgotten. But that's an important word in your vocabulary and in your life.
It is. It really is. And it's, in a sense, a centerpiece concept. And rasa in Sanskrit literally and metaphorically means juice. So rasa has been used in some of the ancient texts, like the Natya Shastra, to explain the kind of mood, and actually the French call it savoir, the mood with which you could perform a dance or a play. But we also use it to express the sense of juiciness in our life and our connectedness to nature and our connectedness to community. And for me, this is where my love of apples comes in, because one of the things I love to do, and granted that my first attempt at growing them was a colossal failure, but I tried again, and this time around, I'm finally starting to harvest some good fruit.
Oh, good.
But for me, the act of harvesting is braided with the act of sharing fruit with the community. A couple of days back, I was in one of our local parks and, you know, invited the community over and passed around these apples to everyone from kids to grannies. And then we just discussed the apple varieties we were eating. We discussed the Jonathan apple, which is like a small, round, ball-like apple, and it has been called the essence of the American apple. Huh. And then pretty soon one of the people who'd come in is actually originally from France, and she was talking about apple varieties from Normandy. So it led to this kind of amazing intellectual discussion of apples and all the different places in the world that grow apples. So, and for me, it felt like this was rasa, and there were, you know, children kind of doing their goofy stuff and biting into apples and just experiencing community with this kind of an appreciation of fruit. I don't know if this makes any sense to you, Mark, but this felt like rasa.
Yeah, I totally get it. I totally understand it. Now, the amazing thing about this book is, quite effortlessly, you're reading this sort of very interesting and entertaining book. And before you knew it, I ended up knowing so much more about apples without even memorizing anything. And apples were just on my mind. Now, I want to address the issue about apple varieties. And it's an important issue because, as you write, there's at least, 16,000? There were 16,000 varieties of apples.
Right.
But the problem is that most of the apple varieties that people buy in stores is just one of three or four.
That's right. Yeah, there are 16,000 named apple varieties. And now, and there was actually a time when Americans had this intense love affair with apples and were growing more than 10,000 apple varieties. But unfortunately, what happened is, especially after World War II and the kind of aggressive industrialization that agriculture saw after that point, that tied in with a movement of people away from rural areas to urban areas meant that a lot of the smaller orchards got sold, and corporations had these huge orchards, and instead of honoring some of the varieties that were being grown, started to focus on more higher producing varieties, but also varieties that were visually striking, like the Red Delicious.
You're right about that in the book. So they look like the apple that's in the Disney cartoon of Snow White.
Right.
And they have uniform, shiny red surface.
Yeah, and also in The Wizard of Oz.
That's what I'm thinking of, right.
So Americans became obsessed with, like, this lipstick red apple. You know, whether or not it tasted any good was a separate matter.
Well, that's another whole thing that comes out in this book, by the way. You talk about when you bite into an apple, it's like hearing a wine connoisseur, right? Reading about a wine connoisseur. I mean, you really have developed that vocabulary, and it's really amazing to read that in the book. Because there's all sorts of things that you talked about when you bite into an apple.
Yeah, some of my best experiences of biting into apples are when I'm out in nature.
Of course.
You know, especially when I know I'm going to an apple orchard, I don't take water with me. When I'm thirsty, I just reach up and grab an apple. And some of the most amazing experiences I've had savoring apples is after I find a feral apple tree. And those apples, and it could have something to do with the fact that, you know, after you're out there hiking and walking for a long time, you know, any apple will probably taste delicious. So I'm a little biased, but one of the great discoveries is that, you know, the apple doesn't have to be a sweet fruit. We think of the apple as this excessively sweet fruit, but going to historic orchards and tasting savory apples has been a real palate opener.
And the aspect of tartness.
Tartness, yeah. And that's where, I mean, in the book, I also do this deep dive into the science of apple origins. And, you know, we think of the apple today as this intensely sweet and crisp fruit, but one of the ancestors of the apple, you know, which grows to this day in the flanks of the Tian Shan Mountains in Kazakhstan, is the wild Kazakh apple, Malus siversi. And some of those apples are really bitter. So, you know, the question is, get to this?
The greens are like that, too. There are bitter greens and there are other greens that have a different kind of flavor. So, and the other thing is you prepare apples. You can eat them, but you could also turn them into jelly or you could, you know, cook them in any one of the different ways. And the taste of the apple will affect that.
Absolutely. They're great in salads, by the way. I keep thinking, am I the only person who slices apples into salads?
No, one of the most famous types of salads, the Waldorf salad, had apples in it. Apples.
There you go.
Apples and raisins were in it. And that, I think, was invented back in the 1920s. A lot of people don't know the Waldorf salad today, but it is. But I love reading you talk about the taste of apples. And I want you to, for a moment, talk about sort of define feral apples. So you're finding these apple trees, and I've found apple trees like this a lot too, that are just out there in the woods.
Yeah, so, you know, apples, I mean, they're an interesting fruit from a biology perspective, which is that if you take an apple seed and you plant it, you may not get the same variety.
Mm.
So to get the true variety, then you actually have to graft an apple tree. However, sometimes what happens in the wild is that, you know, there are apple trees that, as I say, are planted by bears.
That's right, through their droppings.
Yeah, through their droppings. And their droppings are incredibly fertile, not only for planting apples, but, you know, like choke cherries, which are really hard to plant from seed, you know, they do great in bear droppings. So feral apple trees are often trees that have been planted by bears.
Or birds.
Or birds, yes. In the greater vicinities of orchards. And sometimes you come upon a feral apple tree that's just amazing. And sometimes they're, you know, the apples are bland or mushy or what have you. But sometimes it's just like, wow, this was a genius bear who did this.
we're going to run out of time. There's so much to talk about in this book. Talk about, what's it? Is there a difference between a crab apple and an apple?
Yeah, definitely. So just to complete the story of, you know, the origin of the apples, and this will come to the difference. So for a very long time, well over 200 years, a scientist believed that the wild Kazakh apple was the primary ancestor of the cultivar apple, the one that we eat today.
Hmm.
So it isn't until the last 20 years that genetic science has gotten us much closer to understanding how wild the origins of the apple truly are. So during the time of, you know, when the Silk Route was still in operation, the apple began to travel westward from Kazakhstan through Europe, and that's where it hybridized with the wild European crabapple. And crabapples tend to be smaller and tartar than what we understand as the cultivar apple today. And so the apple that we eat today is actually a hybrid of the wild Kazakh apple, which many of them are bitter. There's a lot of biodiversity there. And the wild European crab apple, which sadly is endangered today. And so I think of the apple as a transnational hybrid fruit. I mean, it's both this really highly familiar fruit, but it's also iconic and larger than life for all of these reasons.
The other amazing thing was you learned throughout the course of the book how to do grafting on apple trees.
Right.
And that whole process, it's too long to talk about, was amazing to read about and how you do it and the importance of grafting apples. The other thing is you have so many historical stories, including obviously about Johnny Appleseed, but a lot of other people who I'd never heard of before that are really important to the whole story of the apple. And we're not going to get, you know, people are going to need to buy the book to read this, but you went and spent some time at Thomas Jefferson's place in Virginia and got to see his apple orchards.
Right, yeah. I was a fellow for a month at the Center for Historic Plants, and so I got to research his orchards, the North and the South orchards, and just really spend some intensive time there out in the field and in the library. And so I really developed a nuanced understanding of not only Jefferson's interest in fruit trees, and by the way, he's, of course, you know, goes without saying, a really complicated figure.
Oh, yeah.
But he was also growing 170 varieties of fruit trees.
Now, was that typical at that time?
It was typical among Virginia gentlemen farmers.
Wow.
And, you know, people were just, all of these founding fathers, in fact, George Washington, John Adams, were really into growing apples. I mean, John Adams especially, now we can talk about him, an inspiring figure. He had this cider habit. He couldn't dream of starting his day without a gill of cider, as he called it. And so it wasn't enough that he, you know, he needed to make his own cider because he wanted it a particular way. So he and Abigail were also growing their own apple trees. And not only that, but he was also, you know, he had his own compost pile, and he was experimenting with adding seaweed to the compost pile. I mean, he was really involved. I mean, it's kind of staggering. You kind of wonder, you know, when did he get time to do all of this stuff? But he just loved it. And so there was this deep love of, you know, there's also the necessity, of course, of growing fruit trees, but there was this deep love of fruit trees and wanting to experiment and find out how to do this better. And, you know, just this connection. And my goodness, with Thomas Jefferson, he had so many failures. I actually took some, you know, some comfort from that. And he'd be off being Secretary of State or President, and he'd come back and, you know, his fruit trees would be just in a really sad state, and he would feel so frustrated, and then he would start all over again. So I think a lot of us relate to
I think
that.
His favorite variety was Newtown Pippin.
Yeah, and the Newtown Pippin, it's actually a variety that I'm growing now in my garden, and we harvested
some fruit recently. Did you steal grafts from Jeff Thomas Jefferson's place?
No. No.
Well, you can tell me when we're off mic.
Right, I should have, just swiped a few things there. No, but I didn't. And I got them from a local orchardist here in New Mexico. And I'm growing this and was able to harvest some fruit. And it was just like a stellar moment to be able to tell my younger kid that, you know, this variety dates back all the way to the 1750s.
We don't have conversations like that about the food we eat. No, I mean, I'm saying, isn't that incredible to have that kind of a conversation with, like?
Yeah, and you know, she was wide-eyed when she heard that, like 1750s. You know, it's like that's a long, you know, that's a long time away for a 9-year-old. It's just like, what? So, the Newtown Pippin is an amazing variety, and
we're out of time.
Bianca,
I don't want to get you started because I think you would just sort of rapturously continue on a dream conversation about apples. There's a favorite moment of mine, and people are going to need to read about it in the book. You and your husband Michael, I figure where you are, but way up on a hillside, you spot an apple tree, and then you have to sort of bushwhack your way to. Through this like amazing environment just to find that apple tree. People have to read this to find it out. We have only scratched the surface. There's so much in this book. My returning guest tonight is writer and environmentalist Priyanka Kumar. And we're talking about her book, The Light Between Apple Trees. There's so much in this book. Rediscovering the wild through a beloved American fruit. Priyanka, as always, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Mark.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.